The Jaguars at the Titans kick off Sunday, September 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 43.5. Game overview. Tennessee's run game matches up well with this matchup. Jacksonville can scrape together drives, keep this game respectable, and give themselves a chance to win. In a likeliest game flow, this game does not reach a high-scoring ceiling. But there are a few ways in which this matchup could break other ways. I don't have spiked interest here, but there are a few price-considered pieces I like, and a few others to consider. How Tennessee will try to win. This is an interesting matchup for the Titans and their run-focused ways, as the Titans require some matchup help in order to consistently get Derrick Henry into the second level, and Jacksonville's front is more a weakness than a strength for them this year. Miles Jack and Joe Schobert are both good linebackers, but they're both on the small side for the position, 245 pounds, and Schobert in particular has been attackable on the ground throughout his career. If the Titans can get Derrick Henry moving into Schobert and Jack all day, at pretty much their same size and with speed behind him, he'll have a strong shot at breaking into the open field, where the Jags' safeties are much better in coverage than they are against the run. Put all this together, and the Titans, third highest rush play rate last season, should be able to play their preferred style, leaning on the run and building boot action that produces lower target numbers for their pass catchers. But that does, similar to Shanahan's scheme, aim to put these pass catchers in position for yards after the catch. How Jacksonville will try to win. As we hit on last week, where we certainly didn't see the Jaguars winning, but we saw them making the game against the Colts more competitive than Vegas and the public seemed to be assuming, this offense is not as bad as some people think. Gardner Minshew is not a star. I mean that in terms of football play, by the way. The mustache and the jorts very much make him a real-life star in the OWS book. But neither is Ryan Tannehill. The Jags don't have a good offensive line, but even the Titans don't have a great offensive line. And sure, the Jags don't have Derrick Henry and A.J. Brown and Jonnu Smith, but James Robinson and D.J. Shark and Laviska Shenault are still a solid unit, with plenty of upside hanging out in those legs. The Jags aren't going to win many of these games this year, but they're going to be competitive. Last week, Jacksonville preferred to run on first downs, 57%, and as always, Minshew worked with the short areas of the field an overwhelming amount of the time. His average intended yards, 4.5. Carson Wentz's average intended air yards in week 1, 12.0. So we shouldn't look for quick drives here, but it's not difficult to see this team piecing together 4 or 5 scoring drives, with a couple of these ending in touchdowns. Likeliest game flow. Given the success the Titans have had on the ground against the Jaguars in 2 of their 4 games over the last couple years, and given the week 1 play of rookie superstar cornerback C.J. Henderson for the Jags, and given that A.J. Brown is now expected to sit out week 2 with a knee issue for Tennessee, and given that Corey Davis practiced in a limited fashion on Thursday and missed his practice on Wednesday with a hamstring issue, this game should start relatively slowly, barring a couple of early turnovers, as the Jags are, by personnel nature, a short attacking offense, while the Titans will look to establish the ground game in the early going. If the Titans find success on the ground and are able to successfully take away downfield passing on the other side of the ball, Tennessee is, in most ways, fairly opponent-specific with their schemes, and given that they should be able to win a game of inches as the superior team, they'll likely aim to win this game on defense by stopping the run and making the Jags put together long drives full of third down conversions. That is, scheming to take away the intermediate throws the Jags like to mix in and forcing the Jags to settle for short throws as much as possible. This game could have a fairly limited ceiling from an overall scoring perspective. Henry, Jonnu, Shark, Laviska, and even Robinson all have big plays in them, but it won't be a game of hunting for big plays so much as it's likely to be a game of each team grinding out drives. Tennessee faces far less resistance. Henderson didn't shadow last week, which makes life easier for Corey Davis if he plays. Jonnu will have some YAC opportunities, and the run game has clear opportunities to break through. And they should eventually take a lead, which will force the Jags to try to stay within 1 score in order to have a shot for another victory in the fourth quarter if they can piece together enough long drives. Tributaries. Henry could bust some long runs early. The Jags could find more early success in the intermediate throws to DJ Shark and Keelan Cole. These two and Laviska played over 60% of the snaps in week 1, while D.D. Westbrook was a healthy scratch and Chris Connolly played just over 30%. Or Laviska could turn a manufactured touch into a big play. There are a few different ways this game could turn into more of a track meet than the over-under, 43.5, would indicate. And a few large field tourney rosters that build around such scenarios could certainly be considered plus EV. We saw it just last November. In fact, it was the game that helped me take down the Wildcat, with the Titans winning 42-20 and with the Jags piling up fantasy points as they chased that score. DFS plus interpretation. The Titans are set up well here to find success on the ground and through the air, which, in a way, makes things a little more difficult in DFS, as Tennessee should ultimately remain relatively balanced, which, for them, means Henry losing passing downs and perhaps even a few early down plays to now healthy rookie Darrington Evans, whom the Titans like quite a bit. Note, Evans was downgraded from a full participant on Wednesday to limited Thursday, so he may yet be another week away. And it means no one going over 7 or 8 targets. Nevertheless, Henry has plenty of yardage and touchdown upside in this spot, and Davis and Janu should both have big opportunities. We should keep in mind that the Titans would love it if they only throw the ball 25 times here, and we should also throw away 7 or 8 of those throws as going to running backs and or backup tight ends and or someone like Khalif Raymond on a downfield shot, which doesn't leave a bonanza of targets even with Brown out of the action. And anyway, Brown himself topped 5 targets only 5 times last season, with only 1 game north of 8 targets. But if Davis plays, a good 15 to 18 targets should ultimately flow to Jonnu Davis and Adam Humphreys, and all 3 are cheap. This is a group worth considering from a price-considered standpoint, as they should be able to combine for something like a 10 to 170 to 1 line as a 40th or 50th percentile game, giving them plenty of upside from there, if you want to pick 1 or even 2 from this group. To dig deeper than that, Jonnu saw his average target less than 5 yards downfield last year. He's a YAC bet more than anything. If Davis is healthy, he has the most upside. Humphreys would seem to not have as much upside, but he did go 6-93-0 in the first game against the Jags last year. He's a safe bet for 2 or 3 touchdowns each season working in tighter spaces near the goal line. And a bad game for him with Brown out should look something like 4-40-0, which gives him some juice at this basement level price. He's more attractive on DK at 6.8% of the salary cap compared to 7.8% on FanDuel, where we already have looser pricing. On the Jags side, I love that James Robinson played 68% of the snaps in Week 1 and that he ran 11 pass routes, 1 target to go with his 16 carries. The Jags only ran 50 plays and Robinson touched the ball 17 times, so there is definitely a path to 20 touches if the Jags keep this game within 2 scores throughout, especially if they can have it within 1 score down the stretch. Robinson comes with a risk, but he's very cheap for a more talented than his undrafted status indicates running back in the Gruden run offense with a path to 20 touches. He costs 8.8% of the salary cap on both DraftKings and FanDuel, and we get 11.11% of the cap to spend per position. He obviously doesn't pop in this spot, but he's in play from a roster build standpoint, i.e., most of his paths in this game won't kill you, even if he misses. If he just hits 80 yards with 2 or 3 catches and a touchdown, he can help you quite a bit. His upside is higher than that, he opens up other areas on the roster, and he probably won't carry that much ownership. I'll likely leave the rest of the Jags alone, but LaVisca, Shark, Cole, and Minshew all exist on this slate, and any of them could land in a good game as well. LaVisca and Shark obviously have speed behind them that could push them into a big play or two, making them the preferred plays from this group. The Panthers at the Bucks kick off Sunday, September 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 47.5. Game overview. Things line up well for this to be a get-right spot for the Bucks. The Panthers' offense did a lot of things in Week 1 we need to be aware of. The Bucks should be able to score, and the Panthers should be able to stay within reach. There are, obviously, pieces to like in this game, but there are definitely some elements to pay attention to along the way. How Tampa Bay will try to win. This is a clear get-right spot for the Tampa offense, taking on a Panthers defense that got rinsed for 34 points by a Raiders team that didn't top 31 points all of last season, and topped 26 points only twice. The Bucs put up 23 points against a Saints team that held 7 opponents below that mark last season, including 10 points allowed to Dallas, 9 points allowed to Arizona, 17 points allowed to the Bucs, 18 points allowed to the Falcons, and 7 points allowed to the Colts. And that was in spite of numerous communication issues throughout that game. If you watch enough games of Mahomes and Russ and then tune into Brady, it's immediately evident that he doesn't have the zip those guys have. But in reality, he never did. And if you watch enough of most other quarterbacks in the league and then watch Brady's game against the Saints, it's clear he still has the delivery and accuracy and touch to generate points with this offense. This isn't a Manning in his last year with the Broncos situation. At least, not yet. After losing in Week 1, it would seem to be in both Arians' nature and Brady's nature to want to pepper this scoreboard as deep into this game as they can. Tampa will remain balanced throughout. They threw the ball on 60% of plays last week, which is almost certainly pretty close to the number at which they'll finish the season. And they'll likely continue with this balance unless the clock is winding down and the game is wildly out of hand. How the Panthers will try to win. The Panthers have a tough draw this week against a Bucs team that is solid up front and in the secondary, and is tremendous at the second level, in a matchup where they should be chasing points. Last week, in their first game with Teddy Bridgewater at quarterback and Joe Brady calling plays, the Panthers were near the bottom of the league in pass play rate on first down, and they were near the top of the league in pass play rate on second and four or longer. This is small sample size stuff, but it's also an interesting insight into how Brady attacked his first game calling plays at the NFL level, leaning into Christian McCaffrey to shorten up the down and distance on first downs, and then leaning to the pass from there. When the team passed, Bridgewater posted a respectable average intended air yards of 8.3. Respectable equals roughly middle of the league, or a full 2.1 yards deeper than his average throw with the Saints last year, when he finished dead last in the NFL in this category, three spots below Breeze. He wasn't settling for underneath throws in his first game in this offense, often passing up layups in favor of intermediate throws into tighter coverage. Unfortunately, Bridgewater made multiple pick-worthy decisions on these intermediate throws, and he misfired on a few of the layups he took. Not all of this fits Bridgewater's career profile, however, and with the tighter coverage of the Bucs, he may settle for a few more layups, and may hit these a bit more reliably. Carolina mixed and matched personnel groupings in their first game, but they leaned primarily on 11. One back, one tight end, three receivers, with the play calling built around getting the ball to Robbie Anderson, Curtis Samuel, DJ Moore, and CMC. A massive 73.5% of Bridgewater's passes went to those three wide receivers. In a game in which Teddy threw only 34 times, each of Moore, Samuel, Anderson saw at least 8 targets. Finally, CMC saw only 4 targets, and at least for this game, that wasn't flunky. This offense is not designed to create dump-offs, but instead appears to have a very clear check-down system that keeps all the wide receivers in the mix. Only one of McCaffrey's 4 targets came on a check-down. 2 other passes were designed to go to him, while he was the first read on a wheel route on the other. Likeliest game flow. The Bucs should put up points in this spot. The Panthers' defense is young and raw, and the minds and weapons of the Bucs should be able to exploit this matchup with 5-6 scoring drives, with only a couple field goals mixed in, call it 26-38 points. 8 times out of 10. The Bucs will be further nudged toward aggressiveness by the fact that the Panthers have an attacking identity of their own. Every play in this Carolina offense is about chiseling out opportunities to create chunk plays, and while the matchup isn't great for the Panthers, the whole idea behind this type of offense, with these types of weapons, the speed of Samuel Anderson and the talent of Moore CMC, is that if you put these guys in position for big plays often enough, enough good things will eventually happen. Brady has, furthermore, built-in short area outlets that have players moving across the field with speed rather than catching the ball standing still, which creates outside potential for big plays even on these checkdowns. All that to say, Carolina won't quite keep pace with the Bucs in most scenarios here, but they should score enough points to be in the DFS mix, and they should score enough points for the Bucs to justify attacking deep into this game. DFS Plus Interpretation. The Bucs' offense is viable from a scoring environment standpoint, though it's also worth cautioning that 10 different players saw a target in this offense in Week 1. We mentioned above that Bridgewater threw 34 passes and had 3 players with 8 or more targets. Well, Brady threw 36 passes, and no one saw more than 7 targets. This offense appears likely to spread the ball around, and what better chance to do that than in a matchup where they can work out the kinks in real-time situations on the field? This offense will most certainly produce as a whole, but trying to isolate individual pieces introduces some risk. That said, Chris Godwin saw 8 targets, Mike Evans saw 4 targets, and Scotty Miller saw 6 targets. If Godwin misses this game with his concussion, Evans is likely to see 9 or more targets, especially as Bruce Arians has been a squeaky wheel for Evans this week, while Miller should still be able to land in that 5-7 target range again, with some speed to his game. O.J. Howard ran only one fewer pass route than Rob Gronkowski, in spite of taking the backseat in snaps. And these two combined for 9 targets. 8 to 11 targets for these two is also reasonable in this spot, with the higher end of that range more likely if Godwin happens to miss. Neither guy is a lock-and-load play on such volume, but the upside is certainly there. And the upside for more targets is there as well, though either a game script in which Brady is throwing 42-plus times, or a game script in which a few extra targets just happen to tilt their way. Ronald Jones is pretty clear the best running back on this roster, which says more about how Leonard Fournette looks and how LeSean McCoy looks at this point in his career than it does about Rojo himself. And another 17-plus carries, with 2 or 3 targets mixed in, gives him a very clear path to upside in this matchup. It wouldn't be shocking to see him score a couple of touchdowns inside the 5-yard line, and if he added that to 80 rushing yards and a couple of catches, he'd be taking a strong piece at his price, right around 10% of the salary cap on both DraftKings and FanDuel. On the Panthers' side, CMC is always in play in any matchup in the NFL. But the most interesting angle may be to bet on A, the Bucs' stout run defense holding up against CMC, and B, his pass game involvement remaining down from last year. If these two things happen, and if the Panthers are chasing a Bucs lead, all of Samuel Moore Anderson could see 8-plus targets yet again, and while the matchup isn't great for them, any of them could hit, given that Samuel and Moore didn't end up worth a roster spot against the Raiders with Carolina scoring 30 points, there's obviously no guarantee that any of these guys hit. But the opportunity will certainly be in place in a game in which the Panthers should again be chasing points on the scoreboard throughout. Kickoff Sunday, September 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern, with an over-under of 40.5. Game Overview. Pittsburgh should be primarily working shorter area in this spot. I love the pieces on the Denver offense, as you know, but this spot is brutal. For the most part, this should be a grind-out-your-drives type of game. There are a few alternate angles to consider in large field play. Pittsburgh defense is always an option, but elsewhere, it's mostly just strategy plays. How Pittsburgh will try to win. When I first started playing around with this game, I was thinking about all the times over the years when the fantasy community has forgotten about Ben Roethlisberger, or has avoided him because of a difficult matchup, only for those who took the plunge with this offense to rack up money when Ben and his pass catchers went off. In fact, there have been multiple examples of this against the Broncos, with defenses that were better than the ones the Broncos have now. But as I thought more deeply into this, I began realizing that this is essentially a Steelers offense we have never seen before. These are our first glimpses of Ben at quarterback with Juju Smith-Schuster as the number one wideout, and with Deontay Johnson out there instead of Antonio Brown. And while I'm a big Deontay truther myself, he has a decent amount of AB to his game, and I think he's on track to develop into one of the better wideouts in the league. The truth is, AB was used at all levels of the field, while Deontay and Juju have both been used primarily as short to short intermediate weapons. When the Steelers decide to go deep, they often do so with James Washington, which spreads the upside on this offense more thinly from a DFS perspective, while also forcing Pittsburgh to rely on their third most talented slash reliable wideout for their downfield looks. Last year, the Broncos allowed the 8th fewest plays of 20-plus yards and shaved over 7% off the league average ADOT. This should leave the Steelers relying on the YAC upside of Juju and Deontay for big plays, where they will take on a Denver defense that also shaved over 7% off the league average YACR rate a year ago. Add all this up, and the Steelers' best means of moving the ball will be through short passes and the run game, putting a cap on their defensive explosiveness in most scenarios for this game. How Denver will try to win. I really like Drew Lock for fantasy. I really like Pat Shurmur as an offensive coach. I love Cortland Sutton as a player. Sutton is still questionable, but he has been practicing. And I really like what the Broncos have with Noah Fant, Jerry Jeudy, and KJ Hamler. This could be a scary offense for defenses to try to stop in the second half of the year. But for now, this offense is still coming together. And this week, they have to go on the road to take on what might be the best defense in the league. Denver wants to attack at all levels through the air. Locke had 8 passes, 8 completions. In fact, behind the line of scrimmage last week, he had another 4 passes, all incompletions unfortunately, that traveled 30-plus yards. But the Steelers ranked first in pressure rate last year and first in sacks, while allowing the seventh fewest pass plays of 20-plus yards and ranking 11th in adjusted line yards against the run. Only the Patriots and Bills allowed a lower drive success rate than the Steelers. Only the Patriots and Bills allowed fewer points per drive. Only the Patriots and 49ers allowed fewer yards per drive. Only the Broncos, Vikings, and Bengals allowed a lower red zone touch rate. Denver will look for opportunities to be aggressive here because that's what they do. Vic Fangio and co. will also know that their best bet for a win is for them to keep this game lower scoring and for something to break their way on the scoreboard. Look for the Broncos to dial up some creative, aggressive looks on the defense and aim to keep this game close on offense until something breaks their way. Likeliest game flow. The clear, likeliest game flow here is a lower scoring affair with neither team putting up a big day on the scoreboard or in the box score. This game currently has an over-under of 40.5, and while I had it at 42.0 myself, most signs point to this being one of the lower scoring games on the slate, with each offense having to grind out their drives throughout. Tributaries. There are a couple of tributaries to consider here if wanting to play a different angle on this game in large field tourneys. Firstly, Pittsburgh does have weapons on offense, and they are still aggressive. Maybe Deontay or Juju break off a long YAC play or two. Maybe Eric Ebron hits for a big play or a couple of touchdowns. Maybe James Washington explodes on a downfield throw. Basically, maybe this game remains low scoring, but with a lopsided score. It's not likely, but wouldn't be a shock to see this game hit the under, with Pittsburgh nevertheless scoring 30 points. Secondly, Denver is aggressive. Drew Lock is going to attack downfield. Jerry Jeudy, KJ Hamler, Cortland Sutton, and Noah Fant all have big play upside. It's been a safe move for a couple of years now to just completely avoid pass catchers against Pittsburgh. Last year, Tyler Boyd on a busted play was the only wide receiver to top 100 yards against Pittsburgh on the season, and no wideout topped 101 yards. But that doesn't mean that something couldn't hit if you wanted to get ultra-aggressive with your builds. DFS Plus interpretation. I'll be leaving this game alone outside of, obviously, considering the Pittsburgh defense. Always consider the Pittsburgh defense. But as noted, I do love a lot of the players on these teams. Deontay, Juju, and the Broncos passing attack are all going to have some big games this year if you want to take some shots. Deontay plus the Steelers' defense is also a viable stack, assuming he holds on to punt return duties after last week. Finally, it's worth noting that Melvin Gordon, in a brutal matchup, won't have to deal with Philip Lindsay this week. He won't be 100% back, but he should be able to lock in 18-plus touches with a shot at 22. On the other side of the ball, James Conner now appears on track to play, and he's likely to go entirely overlooked after Benny Snell played well on national television. Snell played only 29 snaps, while Jalen Samuels played 20, so we shouldn't assume Snell is suddenly taking over for Conner. If Conner steps back into a full-time role at non-existent ownership, he's an interesting strategy play in spite of the below-average setup. Kickoff Sunday, September 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern with an over-under of 45.5. Game overview. The Rams focused on the run game and short passing last week. This week we should see a lighter dose of run plays and a continued dose of short and intermediate passing. Philly is going to attack downfield. Even if they don't hit on these throws, things open up underneath. Each team should score points, but scoring is not likely to get out of control. However, there is a path to this game becoming one of the higher scoring contests on the weekend if things come together the right way. I'll likely leave the Rams side alone. I'll likely have a bit of Eagles exposure, though these guys are more strategy plays for ceiling than matchup boosted plays that provide safety to go with their upside. How the Rams will try to win. 2 years ago, when the Rams' offense was humming along and everyone wanted to hire the next Sean McVay, their offensive line was one of the best units in the league. The Rams built everything off the run, with their zone blocking scheme giving them the perfect foundation for their passing attack, with a heavy dose of play action keeping the defense a half step behind all the time, and with Cooper Kupp, Robert Woods, and Brandon Cooks giving McVay and Jared Goff weapons to work with at all three levels on the field. Last year, the offensive line took a massive step back, and while there was some turnover to deal with, this step back also included a tumble in play for both stud left tackle Andrew Whitworth and solid right tackle Rob Havenstein. But here's the thing. Offensive line play, especially in a zone blocking scheme, often comes down to precision and communication. The Rams decided to run things back this year, and while it helped that the Rams got the ball out extremely quickly on Sunday night against the Cowboys, this line as a whole landed strong grades from PFF in Week 1. With the stout front of the Eagles on tap this week, it won't be surprising to see more of the same from the Rams, with one notable change. Last week, the Rams threw the ball on only 44% of plays. Last season, the Rams threw the ball on 62% of plays. As you know, the Eagles annually face among the fewest rush attempts in the NFL. Look for LA to build another ball-out quick attack this week, with some intermediate looks mixed in where they can. Kupp and Woods both had an A-dot under 5.5 last week, which is absurdly low. They were still very low last year, but they were at 7.2 and 8.1 respectively. And look for them to lean a bit more heavily on the pass than they did last week. Side note, last week the Rams had the ball for nearly 36 minutes, and they ran 72 plays. A more reasonable projection this week is 63 to 64 plays, but with Goff expected to pass more, he actually has a strong shot at topping his 31 attempts last week, even with fewer plays. How Philadelphia will try to win. The Eagles are able to morph their offense based on their personnel, so while they were the pass-heaviest team in football in Week 1, that approach should shift a bit as the Eagles return Lane Johnson to the offensive line and Miles Sanders to the backfield. We should expect the Eagles to attack with a balanced approach in the early going here, with this team shifting based on what's working and what isn't. The biggest weakness on the Rams is at the linebacker level. In fact, PFF had their linebacker group ranked 32nd heading into the season. And while Philly will certainly take some downfield shots with DeSean Jackson and Jalen Reagor, more on these two in the interpretation section, we should primarily see them looking to win by hammering the advantages they can find in this area, working to get Miles Sanders to the second level in the run game, and working to get the ball to their stud tight ends over the middle of the field. Likeliest game flow. We think of the Rams as an explosive offense, but it's worth keeping in mind that the loss of Cooks has left them with a pair of short, intermediate weapons in Woods and Kupp, with the third aerial weapon on this offense being the tight ends, each of whom also works short and intermediate. The Rams can still put together sharp, efficient drives, but they aren't going to be straining defenses the way they were in the past. Add in matchups against Darius Slay on the outside and nickel Roby Coleman in the slot, and we should see the Rams moving the ball and scoring points, but having to battle in order to do so. On the other side of the ball, the Eagles, as we explored last week would likely be the case, used the deep ball fairly aggressively, giving Djax 7 targets at an unbelievable and unsustainable ADOT of 29.1. The league leader last year was Mike Williams at 17.4, while also attacking downfield and with Jalen Reagor. Carson Wentz completed 3 passes to these two on 11 total targets, but these 3 completions piled up to 101 yards. We should very much expect Philly to take some shots this week once again. In fact, we should expect them to take some shots all season, which opens opportunities for big plays, of course. But more importantly for the game flow here, it also opens the underneath areas for Philly to march upfield with Zach Ertz and Dallas Goedert. Add it all together, and we should have a tight game in which each team is looking to march steadily up the field, with the Eagles likely breaking through for a few big plays along the way. Each offense has enough quality pieces and quality coaching to eventually put up points against the opposing defense, and any score in the range of the Rams' Week 1 game, 20-17, and the Eagles' Week 1 game, 27-17, would not be unexpected, with something like a 27-24 game very much in play. Tributaries. It's unlikely with these offenses that we should see a dud here. Even with all their injuries last year, the Eagles had only 4 games under 20 points, while the Rams had the same, making the likelier tributary game in which the scoring breaks out of that 20-27 point range. In order for this to happen, the Eagles would likely have to lead the way, either with Miles Sanders breaking off a few long runs, the matchup is average to slightly below average for Sanders, and the Rams also allowed the 3rd fewest running back receptions in the league last year. But that doesn't mean he can't create a big play or two, and it doesn't mean he can't knock the ball into the end zone a couple of times. Or, more likely, with Djax and or Reagor hitting on some downfield throws. Djax played only 37 of a possible 68 snaps on Sunday as Philly heavily rotated receivers. Reagor played 40, Greg Ward played 30, J.J. Arcega-Whiteside played 28, John Hightower played 27, but when he was out there, he was being targeted. Of his 7 looks, only 1 came closer than 20 yards downfield, and none came closer than 15. If Dejax connects on a couple of these, the scoring pace could pick up. If the Eagles hit a couple downfield plays and jump out to a lead, they'll be expecting the Rams to attack more aggressively. And as they work to prevent these downfield throws, the shorter areas of the field could open up and allow the Rams to come together more smoothly. This game could push into a higher scoring territory as a result. DFS Plus Interpretation. To sum all of that up another way, the Rams' pieces are viable. But the clearest paths for tourney-winning scores from these guys is for Dejax, or Rager, to hit on some downfield throws. Fundamentally, I'm not opposed to playing Rams pieces, but personally, I would only play the pass game pieces if playing Dejax or Rager as well. Behind Kupp and Woods, we still don't know for sure how this tight end rotation will work itself out, as Gerald Everett missed a chunk of Sunday night's game with a back issue. He missed practice Wednesday, but McVay has made it sound precautionary with an expectation that Everett will be out here this week. As Zandebeer noted last week in his Rams showdown write-up, after Higby went down the stretch last year in excellent matchups, Everett has been written off by the fantasy community, but the Rams still like him, and he was getting more action than Higby before his injury. Both of these guys work the short intermediate areas as well, so you need them to have some busted plays in order to post the sort of score you had to have, which will likely have me leaving them alone. Same goes for the Rams' backfield, where Malcolm Brown played 44 snaps on Sunday and looked solid, Cam Akers played 24 snaps, and Daryl Henderson played 5 snaps. With the matches versus the Philly front and the expectation that Akers will close this snap gap and eventually take over as the lead dog as the season moves along, these are low-floor hope-for-touchdown plays in this spot. On the Philly side, with Dejax bombing at high ownership last week, I expect interest in him to drop quite a bit in week 2, and with the underlying numbers looking overwhelmingly mouthwatering, I expect a lot of sharp players to bang this drum another week, even in a less than perfect matchup. It's clear that downfield Dejax is a big part of what the Eagles want to do, which makes him A, volatile, but B, the sort of piece that almost has to be considered every week, and the sort of piece that gains a lot of value when lower owned. This is a spot where you simply don't think about matchup and recognize that it's a plus EV play over time if ownership is low enough. For 3 entry max players, Dejax is viable on 1 of 3 rosters if he's projected under 7 or 8% ownership by Saturday night, while large field players should consider and always have a bit of Dejax rule on weeks like this one, where he's coming off a high-owned dud. Again, the matchup doesn't point to this spot. The Rams were one of the best teams last year at preventing big plays through the air, but the usage bakes in a ton of upside. At tight end, Ertz saw 7 targets last week while Goddard saw 9. Although outside Goddard's touchdown, these two continued, as always, to work fairly close to the line of scrimmage. The volume should be there for these guys, but that's what you're betting on when playing them. I do like the matchup if you want to go there. The last thing to note here is that Miles Sanders also has a less than ideal matchup. But it's not a bad matchup by any means, and if reports have him healthy coming into this weekend, he does carry a lot of role talent-driven upside, at what will likely be low ownership due to DFS community's wait-and-see mindset with players returning from injury. In all, there is nothing in this game that leaps off the page. The Rams are still priced like elite pieces, so the solid games we can expect will need more to go right from there. And the locked-in usage for Eagles pieces doesn't necessarily match up well with what this matchup provides, making Philly more a strategy play than a matchup play. Still, this game should have some scoring and should not be wiped off the board. I'll probably end up leaving the Rams alone myself, but I'll keep an eye on Dejax, Sanders, and potentially even the Philly tight ends, trying to grab some available upside and volume in this spot. Kickoff Sunday, September 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern, with an over-under of 41. Game overview. The Bills threw the ball at a higher-than-normal rate last week. Will that continue? The Dolphins don't have a whole lot to work with on offense in this matchup. The Bills should control this game. The question is how they choose to do so. The Bills don't pop in this spot for fantasy. Plenty of paths to solid games, but there are floor questions for cash and limited paths to top-of-slate scores in tourneys. But Josh Allen is always in play, especially in softer matchups. How Buffalo will try to win. As we know, Brian Daboll prides himself on being one of the more adaptable offensive coaches in football, adjusting his game plan each week to account for the opponent. Last week against the Jets, the Bills went pass heavy, throwing on first downs at the 8th highest rate in the league in spite of being in control of that game throughout. This is encouraging play calling for Josh Allen, upside truthers. As you know, I'm comfortable driving that bandwagon. But we should also keep in mind that the Jets were the toughest team in football to run against last year. Just one season ago, the Bills ran the ball on first down at the 7th highest rate in the league. And while they added Stephon Diggs this offseason, they also added Zach Moss to the backfield. Furthermore, Buffalo ran 87 plays last week. We would project them at more like 65 to 70 plays in this spot, and that still only led to 9 targets for Diggs and 10 for John Brown. The Dolphins are still attackable at all levels of the defense. Xavien Howard is not the corner his reputation indicates, and while Byron Jones has solid man coverage skills, Diggs would still be favored to win in this matchup over the course of a game. But DeBoer may see them as being a bit more attackable on the ground, which could send the Bills into a more balanced approach than they were in last week. As we explored in the NFL Edge last week, the Bills seem to look to get Allen some extra work in matchups that allow for it, so we should still expect him to have opportunities to make plays. And furthermore, DeBoer's adaptability leaves us making some guesses on what he'll do. But this spot sets up nicely for Buffalo to settle into more of a middle range of run versus pass. How Miami will try to win. Miami will try to survive this game. This team is desperate enough on offense that Myles Gaskin played 39 of a possible 62 snaps in the backfield. New acquisitions Matt Breida and Jordan Howard played 14 and 9 snaps, respectively. And with Devontae Parker looking iffy for this game, it may be Preston Williams as the alpha, with Jakeem Grant soaking up snaps on the outside in place of Parker, and with Isaiah Ford, 46 snaps last week, 42 in the slot, soaking up the middle of the field work that has the best shot at producing against the Bills. Last week against the Patriots, Ford saw 5 targets and posted a 2-13-0 line. The Dolphins will surely take a few downfield shots, but the Bills will largely force them to sustain drives, which will be difficult to do with the weapons in hand. Likeliest game flow. The Bills should take a lead here, and while they almost certainly won't dominate time of possession quite the way they did against the Jets, over 41 minutes, they should once again win that battle. Allen's most pass attempts in a game list last year looks like this: 41, 39, 37, 36, 34, 33, 32, 30, with an additional 5 games under 30 pass attempts. We should expect the Bills to control this game and for Allen to finish with around 32 to 35 attempts, with a chance for him to fall lower than that if the Bills are in control and are wanting to keep the ball on the ground. The Dolphins will likely have a difficult time sustaining drives, which will leave them chasing big pass plays, against which the Bills excel. Last year, no team allowed fewer pass plays of 20-plus yards than Buffalo. Put it all together, and this is a game the Bills should control, however they choose to control it. Tributaries. There is always a clear tributary in a Josh Allen game in which he makes enough mistakes to allow the opponent to take an early lead. If this were to happen, the Bills would likely allow Allen to lead them back, which could create more juice on the Buffalo side of the ball. It's incredibly difficult to see a path to the Dolphins popping off for a big game here, but this is the NFL where anything can happen. Furthermore, the Bills will leave 60 degrees with 44% humidity on Saturday and play in 88 degrees with 79% humidity on Sunday. Furthermore, Miami is willing to attack downfield, which can make big things happen. I won't be betting on this tributary myself, but there are some thin trickles of life in here if you're hunting for something to bet on with rosters 146 through 150 of a 150 block build. 3.3% of your rosters at a sub 1% ownership on something that could probably happen once out of every 40 to 48 games here. Again, not a sharp play in terms of optimal builds, but the math does work in your favor if you play MME. DFS Plus Interpretation. Obviously, I'll be leaving the Miami side alone. Out of potentially taking a few shots on a low-owned Miami defense, Brian Flores will throw blitzes at Allen, and you never know what can happen in the Miami humidity and heat. Ultimately, between the weather, the limited number of fans, and the level of competition, this is likely to feel a bit more like a Saturday morning JV scrimmage than like an NFL game for the Bills. That obviously opens pathways to betting on the Bills' offense, though the backfield was a true timeshare in Week 1. David Singletary played 51 out of 87 snaps, while Zach Moss played 39 out of 87. And there's plenty of guesswork in betting on the Bills remaining aggressive once again if they have the lead in this one. With that said, here are Allen's last 3 fantasy scores versus the Dolphins. 31.74 DK and 28.74 FanDuel, 41.46, 19.28, 33.84. He's always worth a look in a soft spot. And if you want to go bigger here, he always has an opportunity, when he hits, to carry one of his wide receivers with him.
Kickoff, Sunday, September 20th, 1 p.m. Eastern, over under 48.5. Game overview. The sun rises in the east and sets on Mike Zimmer trying to run the ball to win. The Colts opened up their offense last week with a pass-heavy approach. Reich is great in the red zone. So is Zimmer. This matchup will dictate the flow of this game. This seemingly high over-under may actually be a bit low. There are pieces with a shot at breaking out in this game, and there are ways to bet on this game as a whole. How Minnesota will try to win? In week one against the Packers, the Vikings had 6 first and 10 plays when the score was within 7 points. They chose to run the ball on 5 of those 6 plays. No team ran the ball on first and 10 within 7 points at a higher rate than Minnesota, while the list around them is littered with the expected, Baltimore, Chicago, Las Vegas, and both teams from Los Angeles, and the unexpected in the Bucs. And this paints a perfect picture of how the Vikings would prefer to win. Even trailing for most of their game against the Packers, Minnesota threw the ball on only 55% of plays. League average is generally around 62 to 63%. And last year they ranked 30th in pass play rate, while Kirk Cousins topped 32 pass attempts in only a third of his games, while never topping 38 attempts. Furthermore, we know that the Colts' defense is designed to keep the ball in front of them. With Gardner Minshew's week one stat line, 19 of 20 passing, but with his average pass traveling only 4.5 yards downfield, a perfect encapsulation of what the Colts want to turn their opponents into. Cousins and the Vikings' offense are too aggressive to settle for 4.5 yards through the air per pass, but the farther downfield they look, the more concentrated the defense's focus will be. How Indianapolis will try to win. Indy made us look smart last week by shedding their run-heavy ways and allowing Phillip Rivers to let it rip. On first and 10 with the score within 7 points, the Colts threw the ball at the 9th highest rate in the league, and this week they get to take on a Vikings team that got rinsed repeatedly by Aaron Rodgers on Sunday. As noted last week, Mike Zimmer is likely to eventually get this defense playing well, but his scheme relies on communication and precision to mask talent deficiencies, and that can take several weeks to come together. Indy should be able to move the ball through the air in this one, which should keep them leaning pass heavy for at least another week. It's worth noting that Rivers is one of the best quarterbacks in the league when blitzed. In 5 of the last 7 years, Rivers has posted a better passer rating when blitzed than when not blitzed, and Minnesota tried to make up for their lack of pass rush on Sunday by blitzing at the 3rd highest rate in the league. Zimmer is not typically a blitz-heavy coach, so he may not try this again, but it's either blitz and hope Rivers makes some mistakes, or it's don't blitz and give him plenty of time with his mismatch in the trenches. Not only did the Vikings lose studs Linval Joseph and Everson Griffin in the offseason, but their remaining stud up front, Danielle Hunter, was put on IR this week. The Colts, of course, have one of the best lines in football. Either way, this spot sets up well for the Colts' passing attack. In the run game, the Colts will lean on potential rookie phenom Jonathan Taylor after losing Marlon Mack for the year. Taylor and Mack combined for only 37 snaps on Sunday. Nyheim Hines had 39 of his own. While the strength of the Vikings is still their linebackers, making Taylor a bit of a leap of faith in DFS this week. But we should see a mix of Taylor runs and Hines' pass game involvement. If you want to resort to guessing, it won't be surprising if one or the other puts up a solid game. Likeliest game flow. There aren't many games in which you could say the Vikings are likely to throw the ball 36 plus times. But this is the sort of game in which the Vikings could get closer to that number, as Indy should be able to move the ball in this spot and put pressure on Minnesota on the scoreboard. Indy has been a top 8 red zone offense both years under Reich, while Minnesota has finished as one of the 5 toughest red zone defenses in 3 consecutive years under Zimmer. This is the matchup that should dictate the way this game plays out, as Indy field goals in the red zone could lead to a more closed up game flow, while Indy breaking through for touchdowns against this still raw defense could open up this game quite a bit, to where the Vikings are attacking more heavily, and to where this is also opening up a bit more space for Cook underneath. DFS Plus interpretation. With Stephon Diggs gone and Olabisi Johnson presenting no real threat, I'm a bit concerned about this Vikings offense at the moment. Not in terms of raw performance so much as the price tag you have to pay in order to lock in Dalvin Cook or Adam Thielen. The Colts will be selling out to stop these two, and Thielen's ownership and price are both likely to rise after he turned his 8 week 1 targets into 110 yards and a pair of touchdowns. Thielen can rise above 8 targets, but that's the bet I would want to be making if going to him, i.e., I would want to say, I expect this to be a pass-heavy game, and I would want to build accordingly, looping in the Colts pieces that I would expect to be responsible for forcing the Vikings to lean more heavily on the pass. To put all that another way, if you roster Thielen, you're either taking a pricey, popularish guy and hoping he's massively efficient on around 8 or 9 targets, or you are giving yourself an edge on the field by including that pricey, popular guy in a more unique roster construction that bets on him getting more targets than normal and bets on X piece of the Colts, or X pieces of the Colts, putting up points and forcing this more aggressive attack from Minnesota. Obviously, the second path is much better in terms of long-term net positive ROI. As you know, I love Dalvin Cook in this offense, and I love him as a player, and I love Thielen as a player, but neither pops off the page in this spot. I'll likely avoid Dalvin this week and hope he finishes on the lower end of his range, while recognizing that even the higher end of his likeliest range, 30 points on DK, 24 points on FD, won't kill me if I miss out at this price tag, and I'll likely avoid Thielen unless I'm stacking him with Colts pieces. With all that said, I do think Colts pieces, and thus stacking Thielen with Colts pieces, can be considered here. 23 to 31 points would be our general scoring expectation for the Colts here if we were playing this game out over and over again. And Minnesota is solid enough on offense to keep pace by the time it's all said and done. I put the Vikings scoring range at 19 to 30 here, and would actually put the over-under at more like 49.5 than the 48 at which Vegas has it, which is not what I would have expected when eyeballing this game, and which may be what's keeping this total down a bit. The Colts very much treated Paris Campbell like a co-number one in week one, giving him the most snaps of any skill position player, 2 more than T.Y. Hilton, and feeding him 9 targets and 1 carry. He had a very healthy ADOT of 11.4, while Hilton also saw 9 targets and an ADOT of 12.4. Each guy lines up nicely for 7 to 10 targets in this spot as a moderate floor, high upside option. Elsewhere on the Colts, Taylor saw 6 targets last week, and while he's likelier to see 15 carries and 3 or 4 targets than to again see 9 carries and 6 targets, that usage should still be noted. It's also worth noting that Mac himself saw 3 targets against the Jaguars before going down. If that's what this role continues looking like with Rivers, it becomes pretty enticing, even in a less than perfect matchup. Behind Taylor, Hines is a bet on his role continuing at the same level he saw last week, 7 carries, 8 targets, which would be a bold bet at what will likely be heightened ownership, but is not necessarily a fish move. Hines could very easily see another 5 to 7 carries and 5 to 7 targets here. His floor is low, but there are arrows that point to this play. Finally, the Colts may pass enough to support players beyond the 2 main wideouts and the 2 main backs. Jack Doyle played the 3rd most snaps among Colts skilled position players and saw 4 targets. Mo Alie-Cox saw 2 targets, and Michael Pittman and Zach Pascal were both involved. But these guys are mostly just bet-on-touchdown plays, best reserved if you're betting heavily on other pieces and want to hedge with some additional exposure. All in all, there's a surprising amount to like in this game. It's not a perfect spot, but it certainly has some angles that can be played. Kickoff Sunday, September 20th, 1 p.m. Eastern, over under 49.5. Game overview. Packers have a lot of good matchups here, and will look to run a balanced offense that spreads the ball out in the backfield and keeps targets concentrated in the pass game. The Lions will also spread the ball out in the backfield and keep targets concentrated in the pass game. Their matchup is not as good, but they should be equipped to keep pace well enough for each offense to continue playing throughout. The shadow matchups may determine the ceiling for this game. There are some MME bets that could be made in these backfields, but the core focus of DFS rosters should be on the passing attacks. How Green Bay will try to win. The Packers under Matt LaFleur want to run a balanced offense that mixes outside zone rushes with pass plays that build off that action. A much better offensive philosophy than Mike McCarthy's. A side note here, we didn't dig into this in the Cowboys-Falcons game, as it's not particularly relevant this week, with the matchup and game environment the Cowboys have. But McCarthy's Week 1 offense looked depressingly similar to what he was running in Green Bay, with a mindset of, our talent will line up and beat your talent, instead of with the mindset of, we're going to consistently hunt for ways to scheme players open, and an offensive philosophy that opens plenty of doors against this attackable Lions defense. Detroit lost their prized veteran cornerback addition in Desmond Trufant, who won't play this week. And they lost solid slot corner Justin Coleman. But they are returning likely future superstar Jeff Okuda to the field this week. Given Matt Patricia's tendencies and philosophies, we should expect Okuda to spend a lot of time following Davante Adams, which creates an interesting scenario for DFS. More on this in the interpretation segment. But if Adams is slowed a bit by Okuda, The Packers should not have any trouble moving the ball through the air in other areas, and they should not have trouble moving the ball on the ground. 5 or 6 scoring drives would be perfectly reasonable here, which would put Green Bay in a reasonable scoring range of 23 to 38 points. Given that Green Bay topped 30 points only 4 times last year, with 2 of those coming against good opposing offenses in the Chiefs and Cowboys, and with another 2 coming against ultra-soft defenses in the Raiders and Giants. I peg the Packers at the lower middle end of that range, but mid to high 20s is a very fair projection here, which should keep the Lions attacking when they have the ball, and should open some potential DFS targets in this game. How Detroit will try to win. It appears likely that Kenny Golladay will miss another game, which gives us a fun setup to explore in this game. In Week 1, the Lions played 78 total offensive snaps, a huge number. As noted regularly, the league average is around 62 to 63 plays. Snaps broke down as follows. 71 for Marvin Jones, 62 for Quintez Cephas, 50 for TJ Hawkinson, 43 for Danny Amendola, 34 for DeAndre Swift, 24 for Adrian Peterson, 20 for Kerryon Johnson. As we know, the Lions want to lean on the run, but they also want to open the deep passing, where they typically focus on Jones and Golladay, with Amendola and Hawkinson soaking up the underneath work. Most of this remains steady in Week 1, with Hawkinson seeing 1 target 20-plus yards down the field, but with his other 4 targets coming within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage, including 1 within 5 yards, and another behind the LOS. While Amendola hit the Bears in a soft spot over the middle a couple times, and otherwise worked short. Marvin Jones, of course, was used on both a few short passes and a few downfield looks, while the Lions rotated running backs and leaned on the run to set up the pass. The one spot that jumps out, of course, is rookie fifth-rounder Cephas, who not only played 62 snaps, but also saw 10 targets, 3 for 43 and 0, on a Golladay light ADOT of 13.4. While Marvin Hall and his 4.28 speed and familiarity with this offense seemed a better fit to fill in for Golladay, the Lions chose to throw Cephas into the fire. We should look for more of the same this week, with the Lions spreading the ball around the backfield, locking in on Hawkinson and Amendola in the short areas in the middle of the field, and attacking downfield on the perimeter with Jones and Cephas. Likeliest game flow. Ceiling on this game flow rests somewhat heavily on the 2 shadow matchups in the pass game. If Adams is able to welcome Okuda to the NFL in style, and Marvin Jones is able to do work on Jaire Alexander, more on both of these below, we could see points pile up as this game moves along. On the flip side, both of these coaching staffs are likely to open this game with a more conservatively aggressive approach, looking to pick up chunk gains on occasion, but also content to grind out first downs along the way. If Adams sees 13 targets, for example, and turns this into only something like 7 for 90 and 0, and if MJJ is checked by Alexander to the tune of something like 5 for 60 and 0, this game might not quite reach its ceiling, as neither team will be forced to truly let loose. Either way, it will be surprising if either team finishes below 20 points. Green Bay scored 20-plus in 13 of 16 games last season, while the Lions scored 22-plus in 7 of 8 games with a healthy Stafford, and this game is likely to remain close enough for each team to remain in their typical mode of play throughout. DFS Plus Interpretation. Last week, Aaron Jones played 42 of a possible 78 snaps for the Packers, while Jamal Williams played 31, and A.J. Dillon played 5. This remains a split backfield, and while scoring upside exists here, and while Jones saw 6 targets and Williams saw 4, this also remains a bet on efficiency spot. You're hoping to grab a multi-TD game if rostering a Packers back, as volume is not your friend. Obviously, the same is the case in the 3-man Lions backfield. Hope to guess right on a multi-touchdown game, or hope to guess right on a growing role. Note, the Lions would love for Swift to rise to the top of this pile by the end of the year. So in large field play, that's a bet that could be made. And in the short term, Peterson may be the best bet for 15-plus touches, which is another thin bet with some upside that could be made. But the place to look in this game is the passing attacks, where last week's numbers, 44 attempts for Aaron Rodgers and 42 attempts for Matthew Stafford, need to be weighed against the backdrop of each team running 78 plays in Week 1. There typically won't be more than 135 total plays in a game, or 67 to 68 plays per team, even if each is playing fast and passing a lot. But where each team still has a clear distribution of usage and a matchup that could create some interesting scenarios. On the Lions side, Marvin Jones is solid but not elite, and he'll be dealing with the shadow coverage from Alexander, a solid but not elite corner, who has elite traits and upside. This matchup doesn't remove Jones from consideration for DFS. He carries plenty of upside with his role in this offense, but it should be enough to keep Jones from becoming a ball hog focal point, leaving enough targets for Cephas to be considered an enticing upside pick, and also leaving Amendola and Hockenson in the conversation. On the Packers side, Adams is elite, and he'll be dealing with shadow coverage from Okuda, an elite traits corner, but one who will be making his first appearance on the NFL stage. And here's where things get a bit interesting. Adams saw 17 targets last week on 42 Rodgers throws, leaving 25 passes remaining for the rest of the team. If Rodgers throws more like 35 times this game, he threw 33 to 35 times in almost half his games last year, Okuda shouldn't be expected to erase Adams, but he could hold Adams to 10 or 11 targets, still leaving 25 throws for the rest of the Packers. The Packers' four-man tight end rotation saw only 3 total targets last week. While 10 targets went to the backfield, 6 targets went to Marquez Valdez-Scantling, and 4 targets went to Alan Lazard. MVS and Lazard, of course, have excellent matchups with the injuries in the Lions' secondary, making each guy worth thinking about in this spot. MVS saw an ADOT of over 20 yards last week, after posting an elite 16.6 ADOT last season. Only Mike Williams saw his average target at a deeper depth among qualified pass catchers. This also makes MVS a bit boom or bust, but from an upside hunting perspective, he's worth considering in all styles of tourneys, including single entry and three entry max. I'll probably stay away from these QBs on my roster. I like both, and am very fine with both, but I prefer to grab some rushing upside where I can, and I'll likely stay away from Adams 1 week after he was the most heavily featured wideout on my rosters. I almost always expect Adams to produce, same is the case this week, but I also expect his ownership to remain high. And while I do expect him to produce, his chances of reaching an elite have-to-have-it score are lower this week. But I'll have some exposure to Marvin Jones, I imagine, and I'll almost certainly have higher ownership than the field on MVS and Cephas, given the way things set up for these players in this spot. OWS Team Special. I'll let him get into this in Discord and or his end-around article if he wants, but I want to mention that Hilo has been high on Aaron Jones as a tourney option early in the week. Andy seems to have gotten X and Corey on board. Corey is our betting analyst, which, by the way, will have that side of things up and running next week, with the next 4 written lessons and a pair of video lessons, including a free one, going live and betting sharp next Friday or Saturday, and with Corey's betting slant popping up in edge games during the second half of the week. I used Jones on about 20% of my rosters last week, as people are hip to his low guaranteed touches at this point, which leaves his ownership low for his actual upside. That is to say, he's so involved in scoring position and is so explosive, it sometimes doesn't matter that he isn't used enough. So while his floor is lower than it should be for his price tag, he's still a really good play if he hits at lowish ownership, and he has the upside to hit hard when he does hit. I don't know that Hilo can talk me onto him this week, which sort of illustrates what makes him a strong tourney play. The upside is very clear, but it's hard to switch off the logical side of the brain and actually pull the trigger. But I wanted to pass those thoughts along. Kickoff, Sunday, September 20th, 1 p.m. Eastern, over-under 52.5. Game overview. The Falcons will try to win through the air, and Dallas will try to force shorter throws. Dallas should go pass leaning balanced, and will focus heavily on their 4 core weapons. Both teams are likely to move the ball. Both teams are likely to score. Dallas has the better matchup and the narrower distribution of touches, but both sides of this game are very much in play. How Atlanta will try to win. Same as last year when the Falcons finished first in the NFL in pass play rate, they came out firing in week 1, throwing the ball over 72% of the time, and throwing on 1st and 10 with the score within 7 points at the 5th highest rate in the league. This pass-heavy nature was even more pronounced after the Falcons' opening drive, when they made a concerted effort to get Todd Gurley involved early and often. Given the poor state of the Falcons' defense and the pass-leaning tendencies this team already has, we should expect a heavy pass-leaning attack from Atlanta here. Matt Ryan threw the ball 43 or more times in half his games last season, and that's the likeliest approach for the Falcons in this spot once again. Even with the shift to Mike Nolan at defensive coordinator, the Cowboys continued to play zone-heavy defense in Week 1 against the Rams, aiming to keep everything in front of them and forcing Jared Goff to the lowest Week 1 average intended air yards in the league. Goff's average pass traveled only 4.3 yards downfield. Ryan, unsurprisingly, finished 8th in average intended air yards in Week 1, 9.2, and is unlikely to keep his throws as conservative as what the Rams went with last week, Nevertheless, this spot lines up better for the underneath options here, Russell Gage and Hayden Hurst, than for the intermediate or downfield options of Calvin Ridley and Julio Jones. Gage ran only one fewer pass route than Julio and two fewer than Ridley in Week 1, while tying each of his more heralded teammates with 12 targets. With the shallowest A-dot of the bunch, of course, 7.4 compared to 15.4 for Julio last week and 12.3 for Ridley, Gage also has the least raw upside, but it wouldn't be surprising if he and Hurst help carry the load in this one. How Dallas will try to win. The Falcons' defense is a mess, with no pass rush and a vanilla defensive scheme that relies on talent and has very little. This is a good bounce-back spot for a Cowboys offense that never quite got in rhythm against the Rams. The Falcons tried to account for their lack of natural pass rush by blitzing Russell Wilson 33% of the time. This mark would have ranked 8th in the NFL last year, while last year's Falcons team ranked bottom 11 in blitz rate. But this is a damned-if-you-do, damned-if-you-don't situation, as Dak Prescott excels against the blitz. Regardless of how Atlanta tries to attack here, the Cowboys' passing attack should be able to move the ball. In Mike McCarthy's first game with the Cowboys, this team leaned on the pass, ranking 8th in pass play rate and 7th in early down pass play rate. But Ezekiel Elliott nevertheless remained heavily involved, playing 63 of a possible 72 snaps while seeing 22 carries and 4 targets. Especially with Blake Jarwin out of action, we should see the Cowboys go pass-leaning balanced, with most of their touches concentrated on Zeke, Amari Cooper, 14 targets, Michael Gallup, 5 targets, and CeeDee Lamb, 6 targets. No other receiver saw a target, while the only unaccounted for touches were 5 targets to tight ends, backup Dalton Schultz saw 4 targets and caught only 1, and 3 targets and 2 carries to Tony Pollard. Dallas dropped back to pass on 65% of plays, which is within range for what we should see from this team. Assuming 65 to 70 plays, the Cowboys could swing wildly from this mark in a one-game sample size, but 62 to 63 plays is a round average, and 65 to 70 is the reasonable range we would expect from two pass-leaning teams that will feel their best path to victory will be maximizing points. We would have over 40 dropbacks from Dak Prescott. Given that the Falcons shouldn't notch many sacks, Dak should have plenty of opportunity to drive his offense up and down the field through the air. Expect an aggressive offensive game plan that is able to attack downfield more easily than they were able to attack against the pass rush of the Rams, with a concentrated distribution of touches leaning on Zeke, Amari, Gallup, and Lamb. Likeliest game flow. It wouldn't be surprising if these two teams finish the season top 10 in pass play rate, plays per game, drive success rate, and scoring, and it will be surprising if the Falcons don't finish bottom 10 in points allowed. Each team should be able to move up and down the field, and unless each team struggles to convert drives into points for the entirety of the game, each team should be able to put strain on the scoreboard. Tributaries. There are obviously ways this game could fail to reach its lofty ceiling. Stalled out drives in the red zone could lead to a game in which long drives lead to field goals. Late drive turnovers could kill one-third of a quarter while putting no points on the board, etc. But each team is proactive about scoring, and each team has the weapons to pop. The best way to play tributaries here, that is, to bet on this game, but from a different angle than the field, is to bet on one of these teams winning through a player most will not be thinking of. Gage and Gurley and Hurst on the Falcons, Gallup on the Cowboys. With that said, as noted earlier, Julio and Ridley carry much higher raw upside than Gage, who is coming off a career game that would not even touch what you are hoping to get from the best of these two, while Gallup is still likely to draw some level of ownership attention. DFS Plus interpretation. As the team with the better defense, Dallas is likelier to come out ahead on the scoreboard, and especially with a narrower distribution of touches, Zeke plus 3 wideouts, as opposed to the Falcons who have 3 wideouts, Hurst, and as expected, a 60-ish percent roll for Todd Gurley, Dallas is the more attractive DFS target. With that said, both teams are very much in play here. For Atlanta, 40-plus passes would not be surprising. Last week, 20% of targets went to running backs, which is a very fair projection going forward. If the Falcons hit that mark again, it's safe to say 32-ish targets for Hurst, Ridley, Julio, and Gage combined. If this comes out to something like 8 targets apiece, Hurst might be the best all-around play, given how thin the position is. But if targets tilt toward the top guys, both Julio and Ridley carry upside that can break the slate. As noted above, the Cowboys will look to limit downfield passing, so it's not the best spot. But both of these guys are very capable of beating a difficult matchup, especially if the volume tilts their way. On the Cowboys side, All four of their skill position players and Dak are in play for single entry and MME, while Dak, Amari, and Zeke are solid plays in cash. The four core skill position pieces on the Cowboys should combine for 75-plus points on DraftKings, giving each of them a shot at 20, and also reminding us that if one or two of these guys miss, it's likely that one or two others go off. It won't be sneaky, but I'll almost certainly be mixing and matching pieces of the Cowboys' offense across my rosters this week, acknowledging that this is one of the clear top spots on the slate, in terms of having a concentrated distribution of touches on a good offense in a good matchup, while also feeling comfortable that the remainder of my roster pieces in these spots should still be different enough to set me apart from the field. Kickoff Sunday, September 20th, 1 p.m. Eastern. Over-under 42. Game overview. Chicago is likely to try to win ugly with a foundation of run game and defense. The Giants would like to attack aggressively, but Chicago will likely force them to work shorter. Vegas has the over-under here at 42, which looks about right if we played out this game over and over again. Turnovers and big plays are the clearest way for the score in this game to push to significantly higher levels. Saquon and Slayton are nothing resembling lock and load plays, but they are the best bets in this game for big plays. How Chicago will try to win. On 1st and 10 in Week 1, with the margin between the Bears and Lions at 7 or fewer points, the Bears threw the ball only 33% of the time, the 6th lowest rate in the NFL. Which reminds us that while Mitchell Trubisky looked good, for Mitchell Trubisky, in the 4th quarter on Sunday, this is still a team that is looking to hide their quarterback and win ugly with a run game and defense approach. The Giants may very well have a bottom 8 unit at every level of the defense. PFF had them ranked bottom 10 at every level coming into the season, which opens paths for Matt Nagy and the Bears to attack however they want. Trubisky finished below 31 pass attempts in only 3 of 14 games last year, and 30 to 35 attempts won't be surprising even if Chicago holds a lead in this game. But look for the Bears to try to set up 2nd and short, and even 3rd and short, with the run fairly often, allowing Mitch to play the point guard role that Nagy prefers him to play, distributing the ball to his playmakers on short passes as Chicago attempts to march their way up and down the field. How the Giants will try to win. In the early going against Pittsburgh on Monday night, the Giants were highly and impressively aggressive, emptying the backfield, throwing on first downs, attacking the intermediate areas of the field while rarely focusing on the short game, and looking for ways to move the ball upfield instead of being content with short gains. This will make the Giants an offense to pay attention to in DFS this year. But after a brutal matchup against the Steelers, the Giants get another below-average draw against the Bears. The Steelers were able to tighten up and force Daniel Jones to look shorter as the game moved along, and the Bears will be looking to do the same thing here. Expect the Giants to lead off with an aggressive approach, but we shouldn't be surprised if Jones is eventually stuck working the underneath routes again this week. When it was all said and done in Week 1, the Giants ranked 5th in the NFL in percentage of targets thrown to running backs, and 9th in percentage of targets thrown to tight ends. This team will be looking for opportunities to throw to wideouts, but it shouldn't surprise us if they end up moving the ball through the underneath throws for the most part in this one once again. Likeliest game flow. Both of these teams are willing to get a bit more aggressive when the situation calls for it, but the Giants are likelier to remain aggressive in softer matchups, while the Bears are likelier to become aggressive when forced to play catch-up. Given this dynamic, and the young, less than consistently precise nature of both these offenses, which can lead to failed third down conversions and failed red zone conversions that kill drives or leave points on the field, this game is likeliest to feature more drives that end in punts than in scores, and more drives that end in field goals than touchdowns. If we played this game out 100 times, we would typically see the Giants finish at 16 to 23 points, and we would typically see the Bears finish in roughly the same range. I'd peg the over-under here at 42. Upon checking, that's exactly where Vegas has it as well. And most games between these two teams would finish in roughly that range. Tributaries. The likeliest way for this game to produce at a higher scoring level is for turnovers to create short fields that turn into points, or for turnovers to turn into points directly, or for big plays to lead to some extra scoring. It's unlikely that either of these teams will just put together a sharp, practically flawless game from top to bottom that nets a lot of yards and points. So if playing angles on this game, I would be looking to either A. capitalize on the youth of these offenses by rostering the defenses, or B. capitalize on the nature of this matchup by trying to get a big play on my roster. DFS Plus Interpretation. Chicago was rotation heavy on offense in Week 1, with 60 total offensive plays, and with only 2 skill position players who played on more than 50% of the snaps, Allen Robinson, 53 of 65, and Jimmy Graham 52 of 65. David Montgomery, Tariq Cohen, Anthony Miller, Ted Ginn, Javon Wims, Darnell Mooney, Cole Kmet, and Demetrius Harris all played on 20 to 30 snaps, while Cordarrelle Patterson played on 10 of 65, creating quite a mess for DFS. With Robinson relying more on volume than on big plays, and with Jimmy Graham lacking upside outside of scoring opportunities and or totally busted plays, I'll likely leave this side of the game alone. To be clear, Robinson in particular could hit the salary multiplier he needs to hit, and is a very solid play here, but his chances of a blow-up game are slim. He'll almost certainly need a multi-touchdown game, which he can get, but at a lower rate than where ownership will likely land. So I'll set him aside as a play I like in a vacuum, but not a play I'll be chasing myself. Montgomery is also a solid option as a role-driven, bet-on-touchdowns play, but as with Robinson, his chances of flying past his salary multiplier are low, and the paths to him getting there are fairly fluky, making him a guy I don't at all mind, but a guy I probably won't be isolating on rosters. On the Giants side, the floor is low against the Bears' still solid defense, but the ceiling remains high on Saquon Barkley and Darius Slayton in particular. Consider both to be boom or bust, but a deep shot to Slayton or a couple big plays from Barkley are not out of the question. You could also place a volume bet on Evan Ingram or Sterling Shepard. Ingram saw 7 targets on 41 Daniel Jones pass attempts on Monday night. Shepard saw 6, and hope for a score. But again, big plays are the clearest path to a quality DFS score in this point, and Saquon and Slayton are the best bets for big plays. These aren't plays I'm likely to be heavy on myself this week as a tighter build player, but if you're an MME player, mass multi-entry, a few shots on these two is not an off-the-wall play. Team at Cardinals. Kickoff Sunday, September 20th, 4:05 p.m. Eastern, over under 47.5. Game overview. Arizona ran their offense through Kyler, threw the ball short, and didn't have much success away from DeAndre Hopkins. Washington played fast, but they leaned on the run, even against the Eagles. The ceiling on this game is capped in the likeliest scenario, but there are pieces in this game that could boost it to a higher level. There isn't a ton that catches my eye here, but there are certainly a few things to think about. How Arizona will try to win. There were some interesting elements to note from the Cardinals' first game of the season, so we'll start with those. Firstly, and most unusual of all, the Cardinals ran a higher percentage of their plays out of 2 tight end sets than 29 other teams in Week 1. Only the Eagles and Browns used 2 tight ends at a higher rate, and while it might seem as though they did this to provide extra protection against the 49ers pass rush, these tight ends actually combined for 49 pass routes run and only 7 plays pass blocking. Secondly, Kyler Murray threw the ball 40 times in Week 1, and only 4 of those targets went to tight ends, 2 for 21 and 0 combined by the position. Thirdly, Kyler threw the ball 40 times and passed for only 230 yards. As was the case last year, when only 3 full-time QBs had a lower average intended air yards than Kyler, he ranked near the bottom of the league in average intended air yards. Volume is necessary in order for a receiver to reach upside here, unless you want to bet on broken plays and touchdowns, even with all the hype this offense receives. Fourthly, DeAndre Hopkins was an absolute magnet last week, with an unheard-of 40% target share. Fifthly, it's a good thing Hopkins saw so many targets, and caught so many of them, as his average target came only 6.5 yards downfield. Finished counting. Outside of his throws to Hopkins, Kyler went 12 of 24 for 79 yards. As noted last week, this offense flows through Kyler in every way, i.e., everything builds off the threat of what he can do. And last week, the offense flowed through him in an even more direct sense, with 13 rushes and 40 pass attempts. Incredibly, they had the ball for under 32 minutes and ran 82 plays. Washington, under Scott Turner, as expected, played at a top 8 pace as well, and their offense is less likely than the Cardinals to hold onto the ball for more than 30 minutes, creating an opportunity for the Cardinals to pile up 75-plus plays again, if things again go their way. Once again, the Cardinals will need plays to pile up in order to produce reliable fantasy scores, as they don't produce many explosive plays through the air. In fact, of the 9 teams that produced fewer pass plays of 20-plus yards than the Cardinals last year, 6 teams have a new starting quarterback this season. Another team was the Bears. Another team was the Jets, and the final team on the list was the Ravens, who had 44 pass plays of 20-plus yards on 440 pass attempts, while it took the Cardinals 554 attempts to notch 49 such plays. Put it all together, and Arizona will once again build everything off the threat of what Kyler Murray can do, and will once again be primarily attacking the short areas of the field. How Washington will try to win. Notable snap counts for Washington in Week 1 per PFF, 70 plays total. 65 for Terry McLaurin, 58 for Steven Sims, 52 for Logan Thomas, 36 for Dontrell Inman, 31 for J.D. McKissic, 29 for Peyton Barber, and 18 for Antonio Gibson. Washington was one of the run-heaviest teams in the league on first down, including when the score versus the Eagles was within 7 points, and that was against the same Eagles defense that faces among the fewest rush attempts in the league year in and year out. For as long as this game remains within reach, we should see Washington continuing to lean toward the run in order to hide the slow development of Dwayne Haskins. When they do throw, they seem set to focus on short and intermediate looks with rare shots mixed in. Washington is wanting to play fast, so don't mistake this for a team that is going into its shell, but ultimately they would like to win this game in a manner similar to what the Cardinals are searching for, landing on the run side of balanced while focusing primarily on shorter passes when taking to the air, though Washington will mix in a few more intermediate looks than Arizona. Likeliest game flow. The Eagles, somewhat stubbornly as it turned out, tried to hit Washington's attackable secondary on deep throws, in spite of the fact that their offensive line was completely unable to hold up against the fearsome Washington front. Arizona's offensive line is no better equipped to deal with Chase Young and company than the Eagles were, but their quick out, short area passing attack should solve some of these problems. Kyler will have a few passes batted down, and he'll take a few sacks that kill off drives. But on the series in which he's able to maneuver around the Washington D-line, there's little else that can stop him. He'll be able to move Arizona into scoring position through the air and with his legs, with 4 or 5 scoring drives the Cardinals' likeliest range here, and with outside potential for 6 such drives. I have enough respect for Washington's front that Arizona's Vegas implied total of 27 feels slightly aggressive. Kyler has topped 27 points only twice in his career, but 16 to 27 points is a fair range for Arizona, and there are obviously scenarios in which they could break out of that range of 27. Especially with the help of Hopkins. Barring a turnover, some short field fortune, or a big play to McLaurin or Gibson, the Washington football team should eventually be chasing points here. But most of their stalled drives are likelier to come from Haskins' mistakes or misfires than from Arizona's defense making life truly difficult. This should open enough paths for Washington to keep this game relatively competitive and to continue attacking in their standard, fast-paced but fairly conservative mode. Tributaries. Kenyon Drake, Kyler Murray, Terry McLaurin, and Antonio Gibson can score from anywhere on the field. Furthermore, Haskins has a big arm, and Washington will take a couple shots. While Arizona only topped 27 points twice last year, they regularly allowed opponents to top that mark. And while Washington topped 27 points only twice last year as well, they allowed half their opponents to top that mark. Most people have not yet paid attention to just how short area this Arizona offense is, which leaves ownership higher than it would be with different names on the jerseys, and takes away some of the strategy angles of playing tributaries. But nevertheless, there remain clear paths to a big game from Arizona, and there are less clear, yet still viable, paths to a big game from Washington. DFS Plus interpretation. With so much to like on this slate, we'll need to wait for injury news to fully shake out, but some of the pricing this week looks pretty far off in key spots. And with hype over last week's game against San Francisco carrying over in the DFS mindset to this week, I'll almost certainly leave the Arizona passing attack alone myself. Hopkins kept you on a tourney-winning pace even at his high price tag last week without scoring a touchdown, so you could certainly make a clear case for going there. But given that ownership interest will rise after his last game, and given that he also has some 7-for-70 and 0 games in him this year in this shorter area attack, it's not the play for me. If you wanted to attack with Kyler, I also consider him an always viable play. But again, I expect to be looking elsewhere. I also don't want to go out of my way to bet on the Washington offense, with so many higher floor ceiling combo spots available. But McLaurin is always in play, and this matchup is one he can easily win. And while Gibson saw only 18 snaps, he did see 11 touches, indicating that Washington is going to go out of their way to ensure he's involved. Also, Logan Thomas remains cheap for his role. 52 snaps, 8 targets, and remains in play as a solid low-cost tight end. The one piece I see here that somewhat stands out to me is Kenyon Drake. Drake is more attractive on DraftKings, where he's cheaper relative to the salary cap, but he has the sense of a guy who will go largely overlooked this week with everyone focused on Arizona's aerial attack. Including last week, Drake's touches since joining Arizona have looked like this. 19 with 4 receptions, 16 with 6, 22 with 6, 15 with 2, 14 with 3, 23 with 1, 27 with 3, 15 with 2, and 18 with 2 receptions. His high target games have come in high scoring games, but his 23 and 27 touch games came in games Arizona controlled throughout, which could be the case here. Drake scored 6 combined touchdowns in those two games, and Washington gave up the second most running back rush yards in the NFL just a year ago. Drake played 70.7% of snaps on Sunday, and should be in roughly that range once again. Chargers. Kickoff Sunday, September 20th, 4:25 p.m. Eastern, over-under 47.5. Game overview. This is not the best matchup for the Chiefs, but they're still the Chiefs. The Chargers were run-heavy, but they attacked downfield, and they had a very narrow distribution of touches. The Chiefs should take a lead. The question is how the game breaks from there. There are ways to play the Chiefs, as always, and there are certainly Chargers to consider, including one I'll probably end up liking more and more as we get closer to the weekend. How Kansas City will try to win. The Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes had a couple of strange games against the Chargers last year, in which they scored 24 and 31 points. Side note, the Chiefs had only one game last year under 23 points scored. Just incredible. In those games, Mahomes threw 32 and 25 passes, respectively, while finishing under 190 passing yards in each. In total, he threw 2 touchdown passes and 2 interceptions, while running the ball 12 total times for 80 yards. Meanwhile, the Chargers dominated time of possession and play volume in each game, and the Chiefs had no trouble wrapping up a win regardless. Of course, the low yardage totals for Mahomes, and all that rushing, indicate just how solid this zone-heavy, 7-man-in-coverage Chargers pass defense is. Last year, the Chargers allowed the fewest yards in the NFL to wide receivers, while shaving a remarkable 11% off the league average ADOT and 7% off the league average yak per reception rate. As always, the Chiefs are going to attack intelligently but aggressively, taining full advantage of the defense-straining talent they boast. And as always, the Chargers are going to present one of the toughest challenges the Chiefs will face all season. And as always, the Chiefs have a high probability of breaking through regardless. How the Chargers will try to win. Only 2 teams allowed fewer completions to wide receivers than the Chiefs last year, and only 2 teams allowed fewer yards to the position, which is too bad, because the Chargers went with an extremely tight distribution of touches in their Week 1 game against the Bengals. In spite of the fact that Tyrod Taylor threw only 30 pass attempts, Keenan Allen saw 8 targets, and Mike Williams saw 9. Hunter Henry also saw 8, more on him in a moment. Last year, the Chiefs shaved 6% off the league average catch rate, and they essentially forced teams to move the ball through running backs. Second most running back catches allowed, most RB receiving yards allowed, fifth most RB rushing yards allowed, and tight ends, most receptions allowed, third most yards allowed. In the interpretation segment, we'll try to sort through what this means for the Chargers' backfield, but this team should eventually be chasing points. And last week, they gave an absolutely unheard of 83.3% of their targets to 3 players in Williams, Keenan, and Henry. As noted earlier in the NFL Edge, Brady, in spite of having 2 of the best wideouts in the league and probably a top 3 tight end duo, didn't feed 8 targets to any individual player across 36 pass attempts. Williams, Keenan, and Henry each saw 8-plus looks, with Tyrod Taylor throwing only 30 times. Williams and Keenan will remain involved, but this matchup sets up for each to see a downtick in targets. And while it's tough to call for a bump up from the already high 8 targets Henry saw last week, all of this does at least point to that level of targets having a high level of certainty in this spot. Tying all of this together, the Chargers will look to limit downfield passing from the Chiefs at all costs in hopes of keeping this game manageable, hoping to force Mahomes into runs and checkdowns wherever possible. And when they move the ball, they'll do so through a narrow distribution of touches, and those touches will likely end up funneled toward running backs and tight ends. Likeliest game flow. The Chiefs are not infallible, and it's not unlikely that the final score of this game stays in the 24-17 range. But even that is a reminder of just how impressive this Chiefs team is. One way or another, they're going to find a way to score points. And this is going to create a situation in which the Chargers are trying to navigate this solid Chiefs defense to figure out ways to keep the game close. If you were to tell Anthony Lynn in private this week that the Chargers will be within one score with 5 minutes left in this game, he would likely be thrilled. That will ultimately be the goal here for the home team. Keep the game close enough to have a shot at pulling out a win. Tributaries. The Bengals' defense is not good, and the Chargers had trouble there. While the Chiefs' defense might even be more solid this year than they were last season, with a year together now under their belt. Steve Spagnuolo has done an awesome job with this unit, and it wouldn't be a total shock if the Chiefs took control over this game. It was difficult to get a feel for what was failing to click for the Chargers in that first game. They ran the ball on 55% of their plays, but they were attacking downfield pretty aggressively. In fact, Tyrod ranked second in the league in average intended air yards, and they were moving the ball on the ground. They just simply couldn't close out drives with scores. But it wouldn't be at all surprising if this game is lower scoring, simply because the Chiefs are in position to sit on a lead as we get deeper into the third quarter. DFS Plus interpretation. I have a general rule of you can literally always justify any main piece on the Chiefs in any matchup for tourneys of all sizes, as the likelihood of this offense doing well is always high, and the types of scores these guys can hit make them worth the downside risk. But I've also had a rule from my own rosters of avoiding the Chiefs against the Chargers, as this matchup just makes it so much tougher for the Chiefs players to put up have-to-have-it scores, while they carry a bit more downside risk given most of the price tags here. I'll likely stick with that rule again this week. I see the Chiefs taking a lead and the Chargers stealing clock with all their running, leading to none of these Chiefs pieces being must-haves for a tourney win. But if I do go here, the player who stands out the most for the game flow we should be expecting is Clyde Edwards-Helaire. CEH has a solid floor in this offense in any matchup, and there's always the chance he grabs multiple touchdowns, or is given 4 or 5 catches in open space and busts one for a long score. On the Chargers side, there's temptation to jump on the Mike Williams play before the field notices it, and before the eventual blow-up, and there's temptation to roster Austin Ekeler, or even Joshua Kelly, but I'll likely restrict my focus to Hunter Henry. Henry is by no means a set-it-and-forget-it play. He could land on a line of 4-for-45-0, or 5-for-40-0, pretty easily, but talent plus matchup plus opportunity all line up in this spot, with price the only consideration that remains. As to Ekeler and Kelly, Eckler's lack of pass game usage last week was concerning, less from a blowing a one-game sample size out of proportion standpoint than from a standpoint of, but really, it does make sense that this new offense will feature fewer running back passes over the course of the season. With that said, however, I'm always tempted to consider him. He still saw 20 touches last week, and every coach adapts their menu of plays for that week's opponent to one extent or another. We're still learning who Steichen is, but it wouldn't be surprising if this week's menu has a couple screens and a wheel route drawn up for Ekeler. When it comes down to it, he'll probably find his way onto a small percentage of my builds, as he's in my small, always viable for the raw upside bucket of plays. As for Kelly, he has a clear role in this offense, but it's not quite a Gordon to Ekeler role. It's more like Ekeler has the Gordon role in terms of size, and Kelly is forced to do more with less. He carries clear paths to upside with 10-plus touches in a game like this, but he's for large field play only. Kickoff Sunday, September 20th, 4:25 p.m. Eastern, over-under 50.5. Game overview. Baltimore sets up well to score points in this spot. Duh. Houston doesn't set up great here, but they have a shot at keeping this game respectable throughout. The Texans are tough to trust in DFS, though there are a couple acute angles to consider, that is, angles with slimmer paths to success, but that may nevertheless be plus EV over a large sample size. The Ravens are easy to trust in DFS, especially if you focus on Lamar. How Baltimore will try to win. I watched some of the Ravens game against the Browns. Lamar Jackson, it's just not fair. My parents have been in town the last week, and while it's the first month of football season, which means unfortunately I was able to see them only once for about 3 hours, I was able to grab some time with them yesterday. That was one of the first things my dad said to me. I imagine if we talked again this next week, he would say the same thing about the Ravens game against the Texans. This game doesn't set up quite as well for Baltimore as their game against Cleveland a week ago. The Browns' weakness at linebacker made it that much easier for Lamar to work with his legs, The Texans are much stronger in this area, with McKinney and Cunningham. And while Cleveland is talented in the secondary, they were injury-wrecked in Week 1. But even if J.J. Watt is able to seal off or disrupt one side of the line, and even if McKinney and Cunningham are able to force Lamar into an early slide or dive on some of his runs, the matchup in the secondary bodes almost as well for Baltimore this week as the spot they ran into Week 1. And the Texans' defense as a whole is not a unit we should expect to finish within the top half of the league this year in most defensive categories. Expect Baltimore to remain one of the run-heaviest teams in the NFL. 52% run play rate last week, 54% last season, the highest in the league. And expect them to mix and match intermediate passes to Mark Andrews and intermediate and downfield shots to Marquise Brown as they look to pepper the scoreboard with points. How Houston will try to win. A one-game sample size is obviously very small. But Will Fuller saw 46.7% of the available air yards for the Texans in Week 1. Last year, DeAndre Hopkins led the team at only 34%, but in both 2017 and 2018, he logged a 44% share of the Texans' air yards, ranking top three in the league each year. There is no DeAndre Hopkins role on this offense, as Hopkins is a unique player whom the Texans were able to lean on due to his unique skills, but all signs continue pointing to Fuller being the new alpha in this offense, at least in the early going, as Deshaun Watson adjusts to life without Hopkins. Of course, that's sort of the issue. Going back to 2017, Brandon Cooks has not had an A-dot lower than 12.9, and his highest is 15.1, while Fuller has not had an A-dot lower than 14, and he's been as high as 15.6. This is a team with downfield weapons as their featured weapons, and this is a Baltimore team that is going to blitz on over half their defensive plays, and that boasts one of the toughest secondaries in the league. With the Texans ill-equipped to shift to a short passing attack, and with Baltimore blitzing so frequently, and thus inviting some take-your-shot opportunities with corners sometimes on an island. Last year, Baltimore's defense was attacked at an A-dot 7.7% higher than the league average. We should expect Houston to try to keep pace with their normal attack, running with David Johnson, mixing in some short throws to DJ, 4 targets last week, tight ends, 4 targets last week, split between Jordan Akins and Darren Fells, and Randall Cobb, 3 targets last week, while looking to set up intermediate and downfield looks to Cooks, 5 targets, and Fuller, 10. Likeliest game flow. Recency bias will likely lead most to assume this will be a blowout after the Texans were manhandled by the Chiefs and the Ravens stomped out the Browns, not to even mention the fact that Baltimore schooled Houston last year to the tune of 41-7. But Watson is remarkably strong when facing a blitz, and the Ravens do have some holes up front that could allow Houston to keep drives alive. Baltimore has the better coaching staff and the better roster, and they should be able to score points here without much issue, which isn't news to you, of course. Baltimore scored 20-plus in every regular season game last year, with 30-plus in half their games. And there are absolutely ways for Houston to fail to keep pace. But the likeliest game flow here has Baltimore playing from in front, and Houston finding ways to keep the score relatively respectable throughout, with a few key stops on defense and a few big plays on offense making this game worth keeping an eye on through the end of the fourth quarter. Tributaries. Of course, the Texans could just get stomped in this one. That's not out of the question. DFS Plus Interpretation. Last year, I tracked notable stat lines allowed by each team in the NFL. This is the list of notable stat lines given up by the Ravens through the air. 6 for 114 and 0 to Kirk, 5 for 104 and 0 to Fitz, 8 for 167 and 0 to Landry, 2 for 97 and 1 to Hardman, 7 for 89 and 0 to Kelce, 7 for 75 and 1 to Juju, 5 for 91 and 0 to Auden, 10 for 89 and 0 to Edelman, 10 for 81 and 1 to Sanu, 6 for 97 and 0 to Woods in garbage time, 6 for 90 and 2 to Crowder. If you calculate the DFS scores on those, you'll notice that Jamison Crowder's 2-touchdown game was the only score on that entire list that would have been worth the downside risk brought on by this matchup. I.e., there are some respectable scores, but no have-to-have-it scores. And there are a whole lot of duds from last year against the Ravens that are not shown on that list. It was a profitable move last year to just cross pass catchers against the Ravens off your list, and that will likely remain the case this season, and is likely something I'll be doing myself in Week 2. With that said, Fuller and Cooks combined for 15 targets in Week 1, and they should continue to combine for roughly 14 to 18 targets most weeks this year. Watson was only able to fire off 32 passes in Week 1. With the speed these guys have, especially Fuller, there are opportunities for big plays against a blitz-heavy defense if you want to take a shot in large field play. If taking that shot, you may as well go all out. Also taking Watson and a big play piece or two from Baltimore, hoping this game turns into more of a back-and-forth affair than expected. Elsewhere on Houston, we have an interesting situation with David Johnson, as Duke Johnson is not expected to play this week, and Houston really doesn't have a backup. DJ saw 11 carries and 4 targets last week in a game in which the Texans were trailing early and saw only 58 total plays. Houston has averaged 64 to 65 plays over the last few years. Baltimore allowed only 8 rush plays of 20-plus yards last year. Only 7 teams allowed fewer, and no team allowed fewer receptions to running backs. But from a pure role standpoint, DJ is still a guy to keep in the back of the mind for tourney builds this week. He's unlikely to have a huge game, but there are some paths to him getting there. On Baltimore's side, the backfield is a try-to-guess-on-touchdowns spot. Mark Ingram played 21 snaps last week, while J.K. Dobbins played 23 and Gus Edwards played 15. And in his 22 regular season starts, Lamar has topped 25 pass attempts only 6 times, with 5 of those coming in consecutive games early last year. 2 of those games were losses, and in all 5, the Ravens scored under 30. Including playoffs last year, Baltimore was 4-3 with an average of 24 points scored when Lamar threw more than 25 times. They were 9-0 with an average of 38.6 points scored when Lamar threw 25 or fewer times. As always, this creates a conundrum in betting on the key pieces in this passing attack, Andrews and Brown, as each player tends to come with relatively high ownership, and each player requires extreme efficiency in order to pay off. Hollywood has topped 5 targets only 5 times so far in his career, and he has topped 7 targets only twice. Andrews has never seen double-digit looks, and while he's typically a safe bet for 7 or 8 targets, he had 4 games last season of 4 or fewer looks. As always, each guy is in play for the upside, with Andrews carrying the higher floor. Though also, as always, it's viable to consider exposing yourself to Ravens' offensive upside through Lamar alone, recognizing that regardless of what happens for this team, Lamar is likely to put up points.